about the words on the sign, there was no evidence of that. There was evidence that he wasn't involved in the day-to-day operation of the store. He would help, he and the employees would help obtain the product or the substance, and he was responsible for the financial end. You know, he would take the money and the bank and so on.
And would it be fair to say these warnings were safety warnings about the use of these substances?
Yeah, somewhere, someone along the line had a great idea that if we put on these, I'm assuming this is the case, if we put on these packages that it's not intended for human consumption, then, you know, the stuff's not illegal. Now, there's no showing that Mr. Al-Sharani had anything to do with putting that warning on directly. To answer your question, it would be indirectly responsible because items were sold in the store.
What about the statements that he made to law enforcement about or sort of the advice he got from his distributor in St. Louis about how to avoid law enforcement detection? How does that play into this knowledge?
Well, those statements were all made after the store was raided. The indictment alleged that he committed the offense on the day that the store was raided or before. I know there's an on or about, but up until the time the store was raided, there's no evidence that he had any discussions with the distributor.
What was his statement then? When were those conversations? Was there no time attached to those statements his conversations with his distributor?
So the raid occurred in June of 2013. He wasn't immediately indicted. He was questioned by the police. And I think it was into 2014 before he had the conversations before he told the police about his conversations with the distributors. I don't think the record shows exactly whether those conversations occurred before or after the raid, but certainly his statements to the police occurred months after the raid, when he was basically trying to curry favor with the authorities at that point. So my belief is the record is silent about exactly when he had those conversations, but it appears to have occurred while he was trying to curry favor with the police. The significance being that when exactly did he have these conversations with the distributor? And at what point did he have more knowledge than what he had prior to the store being raided? Another issue, what we're asking the court to find is because there were open continuous public sales meticulously recorded and saved, that this sets this case apart from the other drug analog cases this court has reviewed. Another issue is the giving of a willful blindness instruction. The premise of our argument here is that while willful blindness is deemed equivalent to actual knowledge, and that's essential to the criminal justice system, at the same time, is to be applied, and its scope is very limited. I'm quoting from a treatise that was cited in the Jewell case, which was cited in Global Tech, that Supreme Court case, about the scope of the willful blindness instruction. Our argument here is that the willful blindness instruction should not have been given because the evidence didn't prove that Mr. Al-Sharani subjectively knew or subjectively believed a high probability that the substances were illegal and took deliberate actions or active effects to avoid learning the fact.
what about the testimony from the people who worked at the shop who said things like, well, we knew even though it said not for human consumption, people were smoking this, kind of describing the typical type of person coming in to buy this. Does that play into the willful, the appropriateness of the willful blindness instruction?
It's a good question. I mean, if we're talking about subjective belief, subjectively believe a high probability of fact existed, that the employees looked the other way, I guess, stole the substance one of the employees said he didn't really care what happened to the substance after it left the store. But that, I think, goes to whether the employees or Mr. Alshard actually knew that the substance was illegal. Which is a different question, right? Our argument is the judge should not have given the willful blindness instruction because the thrust of the government's case was that he knew that the substance was illegal. And that's actually what the district court judge said at sentencing, is this was a total scam.
So if the theory is he knew it, then that's the situation where the willful blindness instruction isn't appropriate. Is your point?
Yeah, if the thrust of the case is that he knew, right, then that's what the government should prove.
Counsel, why isn't that a harmless error? If it seems to be, I'm not saying you're not disputing it, but the district court was like, there's actual knowledge here. Why does a willful blindness instruction that was offered here, why isn't that harmless error?
Why isn't it harmless error? Well, it reduced because willful blindness is something that's less than actual knowledge. So the government, instead of proving actual knowledge,
I thought the district court was like, well, the government actually proved actual knowledge here. I get your point, right? If the district court said, boy, this is really comes down to a willful blindness case, and that's all the jury could find here, given the scarcity of the evidence. But that's not what was found here. As was pointed out, the district court was like, boy, this was a scheme from the very beginning. He knew exactly what he was doing from the beginning. And that's, I don't think the government raised it, so it may not be an issue that we can address here. But that's kind of what I'm wondering. It seems like they came with the heavier evidence and got a different jury instruction, but they proved actual knowledge, arguably.
But we don't know what the jury's finding was, right? It's like a general verdict. It's either they could have found actual knowledge or they could have found willful blindness. And so we can't say that giving the instruction was harmless if it should not have been given in the first place.
Counsel, you're well within your rebuttal time. You can continue if you like or reserve.
Oh, I'm all the way to the end. I'll reserve the right. I'd like to discuss a couple sentencing issues. Maybe I should just do it now and not reserve.
It's up to you.
All right. So with respect to the sentencing issues, there was a money judgment entered in the amount of $425,000. Our argument is after the Timms case on the Supreme Court, the excessive fines clause applies to forfeitures as well as fines. And so there has to be some sort of proportionality and some sort of ability to pay determination made before a forfeiture judgment can be entered under the Eighth Amendment. And regarding the calculation of the sentencing guidelines, the court made a determination that the actual weight of the substances to which the analog 167 to 1 ratio, but we don't know the concentration of the substance. It could have been substantially less, it could have been higher. We don't know. Application of the 167 to 1 ratio was inappropriate in the absence of any evidence regarding the concentration of the substance on the inert materials that were being sold. So that's thank you very much, and I'll yield to Mr. Jack.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. May it please the court.
Counsel, would you first address kind of where we left off before Mr. Meyer concluded, and that is, what's the interrelationship of the jury instructions here, and whether it matters if the willful blindness instruction was given in light of potential proof of actual knowledge?
When it comes to that particular issue, the jury had options before it. It was, as argued in our brief, it was entirely appropriate based on this court's case law that the court could be instructed in willful blindness in a case like this one where there was evidence of all the elements of willful blindness. So the jury had before it the option of using the willful blindness inference, which that's all the willful blindness is under this court's case law and also the Supreme Court case law. It's an inference of knowledge in a situation where a person would be believed to have been actually aware. They have to be aware of the high.
How do you view the Fifth Circuit case, Jacobo, I think, that's at issue, where Fifth Circuit basically said a willful blindness, and I'm paraphrasing, obviously, was inappropriate. And I'm wondering, what was the evidence here of contrivance to avoid learning? That seems to be one of the two elements of willful blindness. Where was that in this case? Because it seems to me if you've got a lot of evidence of actual knowledge, which some of which was discussed earlier, but this sort of deliberate trying not to learn, where was that?
Two places that come to mind. First of all, the defendant's statements to Investigator House, and I would respectfully disagree with Mr. Meyer about the record on when that conversation, as far as when the defendant was talking about that. He specifically said, and it's cited in our brief, Investigator House said that the defendant told him that he switched to being involved with Charles Wolf, the supplier from St. Louis, in the spring or summer of 2013, so before the raids in his store in June of 2013. So he was talking about a time before then when he was talking about when he was learning the tricks of the trade from Charles Wolf. And so in that statement, the defendant himself said that Charles Wolf taught him all the tricks to avoid law enforcement. So there's one where the defendant is himself saying, I was doing things to avoid law enforcement.
Well, avoid law enforcement is one thing, not to avoid knowledge necessarily. That implies he had all the knowledge he needed.
It's possible that it could be that, but one of the tricks in this particular trade, and I think when viewing Inspector House, he was a postal inspector at the time of his testimony, reviewing his testimony, one of the ways the operation, the modus operandi of these particular manufacturers, wholesalers, and distributors was to avoid learning that last bit. It was to avoid fully apprising themselves of the knowledge. Here, that's not even the strongest evidence, though. Really, here, the strongest evidence is the defendant and these does not contain reports. There was evidence in the trial record here that the defendant and his wife, the defendant made this big deal about when he was talking with the investigator and others, and his employees also said, we got lab reports. Well, the evidence was that the lab reports that they sought were reports where they would send the drugs to the lab and receive a lab report that said this substance does not contain all of these substances. That's just classic willful blindness. You don't send a drug to a lab to say what's not in it unless you're trying to avoid learning what's in it, because the lab is going to find out what's in it by doing the testing. But they're intentionally getting lab reports that don't say what's in it. And that's really the clearest evidence here that this defendant was purposely contriving to avoid learning knowledge. That's as clear of willful blindness evidence as you can get. And that is why the willful blindness evidence, or the willful blindness instruction, was particularly appropriate in this case. Yes, there was other evidence that the jury could infer that the defendant had actual knowledge, and we've talked quite a bit about that in our brief. But I think based on the purposeful contrivance of these does not contain reports, and the defendant doing that in a way that was very commonly done amongst these individuals at the time who were involved in selling these drugs, it was all a smokescreen. It was all designed to show that they didn't have the knowledge that they actually did, or didn't know the facts that they actually did, and then avoided learning the ultimate facts. So this is as clear a case for willful blindness, I think, as you can find, where you have these kinds of contained reports. That the defendant
is there a difference between working to not know something versus working to conceal the ability of someone to find out what you know?
There is a difference, but I don't know that it's a distinction that makes too much of a difference legally here. The one would put you in the willful blindness camp if you're working not to know. That puts you in the willful blindness camp, and that's why we have willful blindness. We don't want people to really almost know and then avoid during that last thing and then be able to act with impunity. So that's what the willful blindness inference is all about, and why it has very specific restrictions on when it can be used, when you have evidence that supports that. And so that's a difference there, but working to avoid or to keep yourself from being discovered, that's evidence of actual knowledge. It's not necessarily, it's not direct evidence of actual knowledge. It's
Well, do we have any authority in our circuit that creates a conflict with jury instructions that would allow conviction based on actual knowledge as well as a conviction based on efforts to avoid knowing?
I'm not aware of any case that would do that. I don't believe there's been any cited or discussed in the briefing in this case. But specifically with respect to willful blindness, where you have evidence of that's I know one of the other arguments. This court has repeatedly affirmed convictions under the Controlled Substance Analog Act on evidence of willful blindness, very similar to what was presented here. There are no other questions on the willful blindness issue. I will touch base just briefly on the sufficiency of the evidence issue here. The defendant repeatedly attacks the knowledge, and I think, Judge Kelly, your questions about the interview, that is the most direct evidence we have of this defendant's knowledge. And it is true that the defendant made these statements about not only Charles Wolfe happening and giving him this advice from the spring or summer of 2013, but also before that, his supplier, Raj, from Illinois. The whole reason he switched to Charles Wolfe, as he told the investigator or the inspector, was because Raj was getting too much heat from law enforcement, and so he was getting out of the business.
What about this event after he's approached by law enforcement, goes back to selling these products, someone steals them from him, and he calls the police? Isn't that just about strong of evidence as you can get that he did not know that these substances, which are the same ones I think that were seized, were unlawful?
My direct answer to that question is no. What that shows is the brazenness of this particular defendant and his willingness to commit to the willful blindness and the lie that he was projecting out.
So your view, that's evidence of willful blindness?
That's probably more evidence of actual knowledge, but the problem with this argument and the defendant raising this argument is none of that evidence was in a trial. The trial evidence incorporated up to the date of the seizure in June of 2013.
And you didn't put on evidence of his calling the police?
Not at trial. No. That happened 2 months after the seizure. That was not discussed at trial at all. It was in the pre-sentence report, and it was discussed as part of the drug quantity for purposes of sentencing, but it was not part of the trial evidence. So it would not be appropriate for this court to consider the defendant's actions in that, because none of that was before the jury. In addition to the defendant's statements to the postal inspector, the defendant also had his interview with Investigator Furman in June of 2014, where, again, he's talking about, January of 2014, not June of 2014. He again talks about that they were testing the drugs until the DEA labs shut the labs, or shut down the labs that they were using, the independent labs that they were using. I used the term smoke screen before, and that's really what all this was. And so if we're looking at in the evidence, about the evidence in the light most favorable to the jury's verdict, what we have here is someone who is selling drugs that he knows are being smoked, but he's selling them to people in packages that say not for human consumption, despite the fact that they have some obvious marijuana references and other things like that, where it's clear what they're actually for. They put the warning label that was on there in the defendant's store, and I agree there's no evidence as to who actually typed it up. It was typewritten, not handwritten, so there was no handwriting exemplar or anything like that that could be done. But specifically said on the warning to the public or to the customers that using these products is illegal, or consuming these products is illegal. And it said more specifically, referring to them in this store, and I'm paraphrasing here, referring to them in a consumable way will get you banned from our store. And so it's clear again from there, that's again sort of the smokescreen that was going on here, is they knew what was going on. Ms. Baker, one of the employees, said that when asked, well, did you think people were smoking it? She said, well, I don't live under a rock. The defendant himself referred to it as being similar to marijuana, but not necessarily the same as marijuana, but he drew a connection between marijuana when he was talking with Investigator Furman about what it felt like, because the defendant himself had actually used the substances. So to be someone who uses the substances, who knows that all the customers are using it, because he described the customers to Investigator Furman. He said, you know, there were some high-class people, I think is what he referred to it, you know, lawyers and doctors, but then also other people that he referred to as human garbage that used these products.
But what was the evidence about how often the police came into the shop? I know there were some that they would kind of stop in, wander around. What was the evidence on how many times that happened?
That evidence was very brief and sort of vague. The store employees testified that, yeah, the police would come in from time to time. The defense sort of characterizes it that they were, you know, checking out the inventory and things like that. I don't believe that was the type of testimony that we had here. But realistically, we're talking about local police officers who don't have a particularly sophisticated knowledge of the Analog Act or these types of drugs. And we're talking, you know, 2012, 2013, before a lot of these issues became more to light.
Was there testimony on why they were there?
I believe the testimony was that they occasionally would have legal issues at the store. People coming in, the defendant himself talked about the shady customers that were coming into the store to buy these.
The lawyers substances. And the doctors.
Not those. The ones that the defendant referred to as human garbage. He did not refer to the lawyers as human garbage or the doctors. So that was not your testimony. So he had, there. I believe that was the level of law enforcement involvement, is that they would periodically, from time to time, have to come into the store for different things, or check-ins, that type of stuff. It's not like they were coming in, inspecting all of the products and saying, oh, these are legal, giving them some sort of legal advice. It's just beat cops in the neighborhood who occasionally would come in from time to time. And so the difference here is that, and what we were required to prove is the defendant's knowledge, not the local beat cop's knowledge at the time. The defendant himself gave ample evidence of his own knowledge about the substance, which was much greater than what the local cops would have had at the time. And so that evidence doesn't lead to any sort of an estoppel argument on the government or anything like that. It was all before the jury as well, and the jury rejected it. So we believe that in the light most favorable to the jury's verdict, there's more than sufficient evidence. I will just touch the last bits. I'll touch on the last two arguments that counsel made on the weight of concentration of the substance for sentencing. There wasn't an objection here to the 1 to 167 being applied. The parties agreed that the guidelines had changed in the interim while the defendant was out of the country and on his escape status. But 1 to 167 was the guidelines at the time. The defendant made a motion for variance. The court didn't buy the motion for variance, but he didn't object to 1 to 167 being the actual guideline that should apply. But the court, despite rejecting that, did grant a substantial downward variance in this case. down to 20 years when the guideline range, I believe, is 360 to life. And then last, on the money judgment issue, this Timms case, and it's argued in our brief, but this Timms case does not change the landscape. It was a civil interim forfeiture, and the question was whether the excessive fines clause applied to the states through the 14th Amendment, and it's not even close to overturning the Vajrakajan case, which talks about the fact that the excessive fines clause, the question is whether it's grossly unproportional to the gravity of the defendant's offense. And this court's case in Smith, I believe, is probably our most on-point case for that to show here that there's no problem with the forfeiture under the Constitution. So, with that, I will cede my remaining seconds and ask the court to affirm the district court in all respects.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you also, Mr. Meyer. The court appreciates both counsel's participation and argument before the court this morning. We continue to study the matter and render decision. Consider the case submitted. Counsel may be excused.